Okay, well, I'll introduce Lars, but I should say before that, I did have the pleasure to listen to Lars' paper a couple of days ago, and he will take up many of the themes, I think, that Andrew has raised and that have come up in that discussion there. So I've known Lars for quite some time. He's been to Australia many times, and he's written very extensively on inequality and income distribution in particular. Covering the broad area, both on the very technical end of measurement issues and so on, but also focusing on the social consequences of inequality, writing about, for example, the social cost of unemployment in Canada, and some interesting work on public attitudes to inequality. We're very pleased he's able to come. It's in teaching term, so he's got to get back next week to teach. So it's a very short visit, but we're very grateful he's come. So I'd like to ask you to welcome Lars Osberg to the stage.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Peter. It's very kind introduction. As Peter knows, when I last gave this talk, I went way over the allotted time, so he's promised to give me a high sign when I have to speed up a little. Perhaps a good idea is to give you a roadmap to the talk as a whole, in case I ramble on too long at any one part. What I'm going to be focusing on is the alternative meanings of the idea of more inequality. Because when we think about more inequality, we may mean comparisons across societies at a point in time. We may be asking the question, what sort of society would I like to live in? And comparing alternative social outcomes, and comparing, for example, the U.S. and Australia. And if we think of more inequality in that sense, it's natural to ask, what does more inequality cause? What goes along with it? What are the other social implications? But that's, in a sense, the inspiration of this book, the Spirit Level. But that question is really only interesting if the income distribution in different countries is stable over time, if we can forecast that those differences will persist into the indefinite future. I think that that's not really the problem that Canada, the U.S., or Australia have at the present time. Our problem is more the issue of what happens to when we have more inequality over time in the same country one year after the next. I'm going to be focusing most entirely on the top 1% income growth rate for two good reasons, because the changes at that level of the income distribution are much larger than anything we've seen at other parts of the income distribution for many years. And secondly, because it creates problems of instability to which I don't see an end game, which are extremely socially important. And I'm going to be arguing that increasing inequality it amounts to saying the same thing as having differential growth rates at different parts of the income distribution. And the big question then, if we think of it in terms of growth rates, is why exactly would we expect a slowing of the growth rate of incomes of the top 1% or a substantial acceleration of the growth rates of incomes of the bottom 99%? And if we can't think of a good reason why these growth rates should converge, then there's no reason to expect that the income distribution will become stable any particular time soon. And of course, if income gaps are widening over time, that has huge implications for the stability of both economic and social life. Income has to be either saved or consumed. If it's saved, it implies increasing assets at the top of the income distribution, increasing liabilities at the bottom, and the likelihood of increasing financial fragility and periodic financial and economic crises. If it's consumed, this implies substantial differentials and widening differentials over time in consumption patterns and significant implications for social stability. So I'm going to be arguing that increasing inequality over time cannot be a steady state and that it creates interacting instabilities of imbalances. But I'm not going to be able to say what comes next. But let's focus first on more inequality in the cross-sectional sense. comparing, for example, US and Canada or the US and Australia. There's now a very large cross-national sets of data on inequality, and it's worth reminding ourselves that this is relatively new stuff. Only since the 1970s have we been able to make these comparisons with any degree of exactitude. And I think there's a socially important sort of possibility proof out there, that market economies have widely varying levels of inequality that they can persist for quite some time, while these societies compete quite successfully in the same international global markets. And that can be summarized in the phrase, there are alternatives. Margaret Thatcher was quite fond of the idea of TINA, that there is no alternative. But I think that one of the things we see from international evidence is that there are alternatives. Clearly, different societies have turned out differently, so they must have made different choices at some level. Now, I think Andrew showed us this same diagram with OECD data, only he had it tilted on one side, whereas I have it horizontal. And again, so this is 2010 data on the equivalent disposable income. And it's natural to ask what goes with that. And the whole symposium is a riff on Wilkinson and Pickett's book, The Spirit Level. And I note that the jacket note to it says, it quotes The Guardian as saying this is a sweeping theory of everything, which gives you an idea of the ambition of the book and its influential nature. Now, in this book, Wilkinson and Pickett argue that there are a large number of implications of more equality. And they give a hint as to their methodology. It's basically in a way of plotting data or regressing data in the cross-section across nations. And they have a verbally plausible way of discussing it, that all these implications of greater economic inequality are driven by greater stress in social interaction when in more unequal societies. But the question you have to think to yourself is really twofold. One, is economic inequality guilty of all this? And the tougher question, can it be proved to be guilty of all this? And that's, of course, a very different question, because it requires us to think about what should the onus of proof be? Should we be worried about 95% probability of proving harm or 95% probability of proving harmless? If we had to prove that something, that drugs were harmful at a 95% probability level, there'd be a lot more stuff on the market than there is today. But the onus of proof is, in at least in the economics literature, against you have to satisfy a high bar to prove that economic inequality matters. So it's a tough question. And there is another Peter Saunders, and he has a bunch of writings on this stuff. And one of the things that's useful about it is that he provides a little arrow to the data points that he doesn't like. And of course, he doesn't like, at different times, he doesn't like having different countries in it. So he argues that of course, it is a small sample when you look at cross-national data, and everybody has some opinion on each of these particular countries. Andrew actually has a rather nice quote in the Oxford Handbook on Economic Inequality, where he argues that there are just too many theories for the available data points, that we're going to end up with a regression wars with no final conclusion in this thing, because we're talking about concepts which are inherently kind of complex. The idea of health or the idea of inequality, not a simple concept and directly with many alternative possible measures. And causation is very hard to prove in a rigorous sense. It's not entirely clear whether an outlier in the data is something you should think of as weird or something you should think of as highly informative about the underlying process. So there's going to be ongoing regression wars on these issues for some time to come, because, I mean, I'm personally of the opinion that there's a lot of truth to the Wilkinson and Pickett argument, but I'm also of the opinion that it's going to be very hard to prove it in a rigorously and definitive way. Most especially, the most convincing evidence is for the implications of economic inequality for inequality of opportunity. here's one plot among many. There's a very large literature on intergenerational correlations of education, of earnings elasticities, of decile transitions, and then basically they're all lower where the inequality of income is higher. And of course, we have quite a strong economic theory that would argue that. The straight ahead and neoclassical grounds, Becker and Tomes in their parental altruism model would have argued many, many years ago that parents in a market economy, parents will choose to allocate their lifetime income between their own personal consumption and the bequest to their children. And so they'll choose the human capital investment for their own children subject to their income constraint. Now, of course, some people have a more advantageous income constraint and some people have less advantageous. Now, that means they have a greater bequest to the next generation if you happen to be choosing from a large income, how much to leave to your children. Of course, one of the reasons why you have a large income yourself is because your own parents left you more by in terms of human capital bequest or financial wealth. So basically, the Becker-Tomes argument implies that inequality of outcome in any one generation necessarily begets inequality of opportunity in the next generation. There may be some random variation in the rate of return to human capital and financial bequest, but a pure market economy is inherently a dynastic sort of society. And that isn't exactly a new insight. Alfred Marshall was eloquent on the subject over 100 years ago. But there is a fundamental lack. I'm going to grab some hot water here. There is a fundamental omission in the human capital perspective, and that is that in the human capital perspective, there's no actual competition. It's entirely supply-side driven. If you've saved up enough money to get your kids to pay for your kids' tuition at Harvard, well, you just buy the tuition and off the child goes. But in fact, we see a lot of scarcity at the top. There's a scarce number of positions as CEOs of major corporations. There's a scarce number of slots for top schools. And in a competitive race, only a few can actually win. In the human capital model, success by others does not imply any impact on the probability of success of oneself. But you know, in the real world, if you have intergenerational mobility in social ranks, increased probability of upward mobility for some implies necessarily increased probability of downward mobility for others. So, if you think of it in terms of rationing of top slots, there are two levels of implications. One is if we see a widening of the returns associated with the top and bottom slots, then that increases the stakes in the sort of the rat race model and in the pressure that parents exert on children from one generation to the next to do well in school. Increasing inequality increases the stakes in early childhood achievement, and children bear the cost, both in decreased leisure, in increased stress, and in increased costs of dysfunctional rebellion. And more fundamentally, of course, that if the drop from the top increases in size, this increases the incentives for affluent parents to try to ensure immobility of economic opportunity, because it's their children who are at risk of leaving the top end of the income distribution. And so everybody's in favor of equality of opportunity at a rhetorical level. The affluent, the elite, are especially in favor, rhetorically in favor, of equality of opportunity because it rationalizes their own position. But the reality of equality of opportunity is a very different thing. And if it's your children that are at risk, if there's meaningful equality of opportunity, you can expect less political support over time. So that, of course, assumes that stability of inequality levels are constant. And I'd argue that that isn't anything like our current problem in the U.S. or Canada or Australia. Because I'd argue that our current problem is that of increasing inequality over time. there's no stable level of the Gini index. Let me flip over this because we'll go on. This also, Andrew showed you the picture for Australia. And this simply adds the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. And you can see in all these countries, very high levels of income shares of the top 1% in the 1920s and 1930s, precipitous declines into the 50s, 60s, and then an acceleration of the shares of the top 1% in the beginning about 1980 or the middle 1980s in some countries. Now, as he noted, in this, Australia is a little bit different than the U.S. or Canada. If you plot out the real incomes of different percentiles of the income distribution in Canada or the U.S., the flatness of real incomes at the 20th, 40th, 50th, 60th, and 80th percentiles is really quite astounding. In Australia, you have seen real income growth in the bottom 90%. In particular, you have seen real income growth at the bottom, and that's kind of important because the thing I want to emphasize about income shares is that they're really a ratio. The income share of the top 1% is really the incomes of the top 1% divided by the incomes of everybody else. And so it's useful to ask ourselves the question, where is the action being in income shares? Is it the movements in the numerator or movements in the denominator that are driving these shares over time? If we go back to this sort of picture here, we might think that we're kind of just returning to a stable distribution, which we observed before, and we might think that the top 1% have actually been falling in real incomes. But in fact, what's been going on, I want to go forward, don't I? In fact, what's been happening is simply differential growth rates at different parts of the income distribution. And here, I want to focus on the income growth rate of the bottom 90% of the distribution, the 90th to 95th, the 95th to 99th, 99th to 99.5, 99.5 to 99.9, and above. And a consistent story in all these three Anglo countries is the escalating rates of growth, long-term rates of growth of income, as the farther you go up the income distribution. I mean, it's a bit arbitrary to pick the top 1% as the focus of attention. You could go for the top 0.1 or half of 1%, but it seems that it really starts to accelerate in income growth rates, long-term income growth rates, as you hit the top 1% of the income distribution. Now, here's Australia, of course, where you have seen income growth at the bottom, but it is still the same picture in terms of differential of income growth between the bottom 90% and the top few percentile parts of the distribution. What's remarkable about Canada and Australia, Canada and the U.S. rather, is how little income growth you've seen for the bottom 90% and even more for the median and lower quintiles. So, the thing about the top 1% real incomes is that there's no natural upper bound to those incomes. Their declining income share in the 1950s and 1960s wasn't because real incomes fell, it's just because they grew slowly, more slowly than income growth in the rest of the income distribution. It's in the 1980s, where's this pointer here? In the 1980s, you see this acceleration, it's a bit unstable, with a few cyclical fluctuations in the U.S., and you see this acceleration a little bit later starting in Canada and Australia. Now, in Canada, we have something called Canadian-controlled private corporations, which are a way of tax-sheltering income at the top end. And so in the U.S., they have similar legal instruments, but the income is attributed back to the individual taxpayers. So these numbers aren't quite comparable. There should be something in there for these CCPCs, and that research is ongoing. But the key thing I want to focus on is income growth rates at the top and at the bottom. And I want to particularly focus on them because when I went off to grad school, back in here, the standard thing was to talk about income distribution as being about as interesting as watching grass grow, because there just wasn't much action. And at that point in time, economists got focused on the idea of representative agents and balanced growth. And there was a period in the US in which income growth rates were relatively similar, both at the very top end and at the rest of the income distribution. Now, overall, for the period as a whole, you have this period of very rapid income growth at the bottom end and compressed income differentials. And since 1980, a much more rapid income growth at the top. So it's a bit, I mean, this was a historically unique period of balanced income growth. And the thing about balanced income growth is at that point, when income growth rates are the same or very similar at all percentiles of the income distribution, then the income distribution is stable. And we can think realistically about stable choices between steady states. But when income growth rates are very different at the top than at the bottom, that's a process of ever accelerating inequality. Now, the Canadian picture is a little bit different in the sense that there's a little bit of a differential in income growth rates, and the period of rough balance is a bit longer, but you still see the same emergence of a big gap in income growth rates since about the mid-1980s. Particularly coinciding with the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1987. So, also the same period of big compression starting in 1940 with very rapid income, much more rapid income growth at the bottom. Now, of course, that period, 1940 to 70, had a whole bunch of sort of one-off influences. Andrew's already mentioned the impact in Australia of the wartime boom and the wartime control period. We also had substantial structural change, a big movement out of agriculture, industrialization. We had massive increases in secondary and post-secondary education. We had a massive increase in female labor force participation. All these are trends with huge implications for household incomes, and these are all trends that essentially only happen once. So you had capital deepening, you had a baby boom, you had a strong union movement in both Canada and the U.S. And in fact, you also had all through this period what I would argue is a threat effect in social policy. And as far as I can tell, people in the elite in Canada and the U.S. did take the communist menace quite seriously. And it was something certainly people talked about quite a lot. Australia, what's Australia look like? A little bit of a different picture up until the 1980s, a period of compression with much more rapid income growth at the bottom than at the top. But again, the same picture of an accelerating differential post-1985. Now, my story is one of differential growth rates of income at different parts of the income distribution. And the question, of course, is what will that imply if that continues? 1984, the top 1% had an income that was on average 8 times the median household income. By 2011, had more than doubled to 17.2%, 17.2 times the income of the median household. Now, a differential in growth rates of like about 2.84% is not a big deal if it only happens for a couple of years in a row. But if it happens for 30 years in a row, or even for the next 20 years as it has happened for the last 30 years, then compound growth rates have this incredible logic. 20 years from now, that's a 30 to 1 ratio. If 2038, that's up to 36 times. Now you can say, well, this is just too large to believe, but exactly why would it change? So what I want to focus on is the idea of how do you frame the question? You think of it in terms of levels and inequality at a point in time, or do you think of it in terms of differential growth rates and increasing income gaps over time? If you think of it as there are two different ways of describing the same reality in the same way as a glass can be half full or half empty, but they do have different suggestions to them. Because if you think of it in terms of differential growth rates, then the question is, why would growth rates equalize? What's going to accelerate growth rates at the of income at the bottom? What's going to, in a big way, or what's going to decelerate growth rates at the top in a big way? And if you think of it in terms of differential growth rates, then one-off changes like income tax changes or marginal tax rate changes won't do the trick. You need a series of changes to have a continual differential in growth rates. So what exactly is the auto-equilibrating market mechanism that's going to equalize income growth rates at the very top and for the rest of society? It has to be some sort of labor market story, because labor compensation is a very big component of the incomes of the top 1%. Could it be perhaps that the top 1% kind of run out of steam? This is the labor market incentive stories that Andrew referred to. I personally find that extremely unconvincing. The increase in incomes at the very top end of the U.S. income distribution have been of the order of 3-1 comparing in 1982 and 2011. Is it really plausible to think of the very top, the elite of the U.S. As working like one-third as hard in 1982 compared to now? And there is, after all, a maximum to work hours. There has to be some sort of, we know what the maximum hours is. I can't imagine that effort or intensity per hour can increase without a limit either. The idea that this is all a labor supply story, I find kind of implausible. I find much more plausible the idea that there's a segmented labor market out there, that top 1% incomes can be thought of as kind of the globals and their peers, so sort of the superstar phenomenon that Andrew was talking about, but more generalized to the returns to top corporate positions. The literature on CEO compensation in the U.S. Focuses particularly on the increasing size of U.S. corporations to explain the massive increase in CEO skilled worker differentials. So if we've had a massive increase in globalization of markets, and if firms that used to be national are now multinational, then that sets up the possibility of monopolistically competitive firms for whom the top corporate management gets a share of profits. Profits which are growing at approximately the rate of global GDP, more or less. Locals, on the other hand, have to compete for their jobs with workers in many other potential locations, and the average rate of growth of labor productivity kind of sets an upper bound for the rate of growth of wages over time. And the point of outlining this as a sort of a potted short theory is to say that there's at least one perspective that would argue that these differential growth rates at the very top and for the rest of society can well continue for many years to come. And of course, the implication is that differential in income growth rates will persist. And what plausible alternative model is there? Could more education slow this process down? Now Andrew did mention the importance of education, and for most of the distribution, I'm a big fan of education. I'm in the business, as it were. And for equalization of opportunity among the 99%, it's a great thing. But there's no reason to think that that's going to accelerate the average income growth of the bottom 99% of the distribution. And in particular, in Canada, we've been there and we've done that. There's Canada has a 13 percentage point higher tertiary education attainment level than Australia, and significantly higher than the U.S., and there's no evidence whatsoever in the Canadian data of a convergence of income growth for the bulk of the population and the top 1%. In fact, Australia is the only one of these three countries where you've seen real income growth at the bottom part of the income distribution, and Australia is the one with the least level of educational attainment. So I'd argue, now how much time do I have, Peter? Five, okay. So what are the implications, I'm going to slip over this, what are the implications of continued unbalanced growth? Well, income it doesn't stop with income. Income has to be either saved or consumed. If income is saved at the top end, then increasing top-end incomes necessarily imply an increased flow of savings into financial markets. How do you save? You purchase financial assets. Well, a financial asset always has the characteristic that what's a financial asset to one person is a financial liability to another person. If we're going to have enough aggregate expenditure in the economy as a whole to balance aggregate demand and aggregate supply, then we're going to have some people spending more than their income if others are spending less than their income. And that's a recipe, as Kumhoff and Rancière have argued, for accumulating debts at the bottom to match the accumulating, which are just the flip side of the accumulating assets at the top of the income distribution. Financial fragility, financial crises, periodic financial crises, and real recessions are the outcome if you have an unbalanced growth of income at different parts of the income distribution. Now, of course, that has major implications for the debt stability, public and private. I'm going to flash over this because I just really want to emphasize the idea that the debt overhang compounds in impact whenever interest rates exceed the growth rate. So accumulated deficits imply accumulated increasing debt to GDP ratios, increasing deficits imply increasing debt. Now, of course, Canada, Australia, and the U.S. with independent currencies can keep interest rates low for some period of time to make financing debt easy. But that, of course, just increases the incentives for people to compound their household debt. And certainly in Canada, we're at historic highs in private household debt to income ratios. And it creates the problem of how do you get out of this low interest rate environment? When you increase interest rates to more normal levels, you magnify the importance of your previous overhang of past debt. But I also want to talk a little bit also about the consumption side. What happens to the income that's consumed? After all, in historic periods of great inequality, the elite did consume extravagantly, and that was a way of recycling purchasing power. It did maintain macroeconomic stability. I'm not sure how many people watch here the program Downton Abbey, and it's celebration of the faithful retainers and the extravagant consumption of the elite. But of course, in periods of long and stable high inequality, everybody gets used to the idea of high inequality. It becomes the natural order of things, both for both the servants and the served. The thing about increasing gaps in income is it requires increasingly extravagant consumption by the elite in order to balance consumption, expenditure, and output. So norms of luxury become increasingly distant from the median. And of course, that implies a market opportunity. As the percentage of income held by the top 1% increases in size, that's an increasing market for luxury commodities. Luxury commodities are primarily status goods. Status goods which are convince the purchaser of those goods that they're special, privileged, and exclusive for purchasing that particular handbag for thousands of dollars or that particular watch for thousands of dollars. And of course, the only way you can be sure that it really is special and exclusive is if other people know it's special and exclusive. So if you think it's special and exclusive and nobody else does, it's kind of a pointless purchase. So advertising has to increasingly remind the bottom 99% of what the top 1% have that makes them special, in order for the to be successful in its job. And advertising to the elite becomes an increasing fraction over time of the ad buy that bombards us in every day. So in a very real sense, increasing inequality increases market incentives to manufacture envy. Externalities. Well, why don't we just try and ignore all this and pretend that the top 1% are living on some reservation somewhere out of contact with the rest of us? And which in a certain sense, the infrastructure of inequality does create. One reason is because the top 1% refuse to be ignored politically. They want to use their assets to purchase influence and importance in the public arena. And the U.S. political scientists have been all over this in terms of the impact of top donors on the U.S. political system. And fundamentally, political influence is a zero-sum game. The more influence for one, the less influence for another. To the extent that the increasing income of the top 1% enable them to purchase more political influence, that means less political influence for everybody else. Externality, too, is advantages for your kids. You can expect both an income effect and what you could call a price effect. As incomes increase at the very top end, it's natural for parents to want to spend even more and more and more on purchasing the maximum amount of advantages they can for their children. But there's also a price effect, if you will, that if you don't purchase these advantages for your kids, that their drop from the top is now larger than it ever was before. And that's ever greater incentives to the top end to prevent downward social mobility for their own children. And of course, when the top 1% avoid downward mobility for their own children, that it decreases the chances of upward mobility for everybody else. So maintaining belief in equality of opportunity becomes increasingly difficult over time. Now, if markets won't solve this problem for us, and I see no candidate theory that says that economic markets will automatically solve this problem, then can we depend on political economy? I mean, many people have by now well forgotten what a social policy leader the U.S. came under FDR, became under FDR in the 1930s. And the whole package of cyclical stimulus, structural reforms, progressive taxation, social security, and encouragement of unionization and the like had a major impact on stabilizing the U.S. For some 50 years. And in principle, even if we have continually diverging market incomes, the instability implications of increasing inequality depend on post-tax and transfer income. So you could, in some sense, potentially stabilize the post-tax transfer and distribution of income by increasing the role of the state. But both in Canada, the U.S., and Australia, how likely is that currently? So my bottom line is that the unsustainable doesn't last, but it's not entirely clear what follows. That unbalanced income growth and ever-increasing inequality over time are just flip sides of each other, different ways of saying the same thing. But this cannot be a steady state. It produces many interacting instabilities, both economic, political, and social, with cumulative impacts. Now, in previous periods of economic instability, we've seen political choices, some of which have been disastrous, and some of which have created enduring social models. And disastrous, I would think of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. Of enduring social models, I would think of the Scandinavian social democracies. But it's certainly far from automatic that societies make necessarily positive choices, but we can be sure that those choices matter in a very big way. Thanks very much.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions. I'll take 5 minutes of the tea break because we started a bit late. The first question's over there, and I can see a hand up there as well. So,
Lars, thanks very much for a very challenging and interesting talk. A whole set of questions about legitimacy, productivity, power, sustainability. But I wanted to put in the extra little piece in the jigsaw, which is happiness. Now, Wilkinson and Pickett, as you know, make a lot of the evidence that more unequal societies are more unhappy societies. Indeed, even arguing that economists for the last 200 years have been operating on the wrong assumption, that more income would create more happiness, whereas at a societal level, it's more equality that creates happiness. Now, does that lead to more clarity in your conclusion about the political consequences of an increasingly unequal society as an increasingly unhappy society, and therefore perhaps leading to what the extreme political responses to which you've briefly alluded.
I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but there is, I think, quite persuasive evidence on more unequal societies being more unhappy as an empirical matter. And one would expect that to be the case, because if you survey individuals and ask them whether they think there's too much inequality, the overwhelming response in all the ISSP or World Value Survey data is that whatever level of inequality you actually have, you would like more equality, and that's it's quite consistent results. If we think of this in terms of the issue of growth rates and the growing divergence between elite incomes and median incomes, and the increasing ad buy that tries to persuade potential buyers of fancy watches that they're special and privileged and wonderful if they can buy this commodity, then increasingly the media will remind the 99% of what they can never possibly buy. And that's a little bit different than a stable, low inequality society, where most of the advertising is about, selling Fords versus Chevs, things that you could possibly fit into your universe of discourse. But if most of the ads are about Porsches and Ferraris and Maseratis, and you know that really special people have those things, but I guess I'm not one of them, that's kind of an incentive, that's a dynamic argument for more unhappiness accompanying more inequality over time.
Yep.
Thanks very much, Lars. It's Quentin Grafton at the ANU. Welcome to Australia. Look, the last slide that you had was in relation to what might happen in the context of instability. And I just wanted to raise the issue of what's going on in Greece at the moment. I've been flabbergasted. I'm not a Greek specialist, but incomes have fallen, I think, somewhere between 20-25%, more to come. They still have a vibrant democracy. I know there's been some concerns about certain political parties, but nevertheless, they're still in the Eurozone, still wish to continue in the Euro, yet it appears to continue. I'm sort of flabbergasted that has happened, and I wanted you to comment in relation to other countries and the ability to adjust to what I would see are huge structural adjustments over relatively short periods of time.
I think in Greece now you could widen the zone of comparisons to Italy or Spain with very large base unemployment rates and extremely high rates of youth unemployment, and up to now you have a buffering impact of the assets of older generations and the residual welfare state that's there. But of course, the question is how long do those buffering mechanisms actually last? And what my core argument is that we have within Canada, U.S., and Australia seen differential growth rates of income that have lasted for 30 years now. And we ought to get used to the idea that this is actually the new normal. And over time, if it continues, you have little bits of buffering for short-term business cycle shocks or whatever. But it is like a pressure cooker in which it seems to me pressure builds up over time. And so I really can't quite see how it's going to be something that can be coped with by these buffering mechanisms equally well. Well, maybe next year it can work, but 5 years, 10 years? Just how far off into the future do these buffering mechanisms work?
Okay, I have a number of people with their hands up, but I'm going to restrict it to just two. Jeff's already had a go. Three with Sue. So I'm going to ask these three speakers to ask their questions in sequence, and then we'll let Lars try and answer them together.
Well, you're going to test my memory then, eh?
Yeah, sorry.
So I'll write it down.
One at the back, then Hal, and then Sue Richardson. Yep.
Thank you, Peter. I wanted to ask about the transnational effects of the luxury goods market, but also of advertising. So I'm clearly thinking about China and the explosion of luxury goods there, but also of transnational populations working between China, Australia, Canada, the US, and the kind of impacts that might have both within particular percentages of the new rich, but also whether that does in fact trickle down to other populations or whether it's in some way sequestered.
So we'll take them all, Hal, next, and then Sue.
Yes, well, another dimension here, of course, is many of these effects and consequences are specific to a point in the lifespan, and they accumulate for cohorts through time, and society is changing. Do you have any observations about how the accumulation of these inequalities have implications in how it's going to play out in terms of relationships between generations and cohorts?
This will be the last one, and then we'll give...
Sue Richardson. One of the arguments that the elites use to defend their thievery is that they don't just save and hence produce the deficit issues that you drew attention to or consume in extreme ways. They invest, they buy equity, they create jobs, and hence they're an engine of opportunity and growth for the 99%. I'd just be interested in your comment on that.
So 3 minutes last to address those three points.
Three minutes. Let me come back to the first. Of course, in a globalized world, you're referring particularly to the growth of luxury consumption and the accelerating inequality that you see in particular in China. Now, in a globalized world, that accelerating inequality in China creates massive amounts of wealth for the Chinese elite. And in Kumoff's story with the IMF, has played a major role in fact, enabling the U.S. To build up its stock of liabilities internationally, partly because it's difficult for the elite in China to lend to their domestic consumers. So we have international instabilities on the savings side. On the consumption side, Louis Vuitton handbags and Nike swooshes that are marketed so successfully to affluent people are also marketed in China, and the incomes from those trademarks flows back to swell the incomes at the top end of the income distribution, and that's one of the examples I would use of why globalized markets create this rate of growth of income at the top end, which is really a function of the rate of growth of global markets. So the internationalization of consumption aspirations in that sense creates all the same pressures within those other increasingly unequal societies as it does within Canada, the US, and Australia. Now, on the issue of lifespans and cohorts and the between generation issue, I think one of the things that you don't quite perceive when you just look at the flatness of real incomes at different points in the income distribution is life cycle progression in income as people move up age earnings profiles. But in the Canadian literature, there's been quite a recognition that although Canadians are much better educated now than they were 20 and 30 and 40 years ago, entering cohorts of young workers have age earnings profiles that are systematically shifted down for successive entrants into the labor market. So we have, for most of the population, a life cycle stagnancy in real incomes, real money incomes, which masks, of course, the increased time investment of households in producing those market incomes. I mean, if you price out the increased labor supply of both household, both men and women in households, that translates to a decline in real living standards for much of the income distribution. The between generation thing is rather interesting, because of course these top end incomes, they may have started off as labor incomes, but to the extent they're saved, they become wealth. And become inheritable as financial capital from one generation to the next. So in that sense, increasing inequality of labor incomes becomes ultimately more embedded in increased inequality of labor plus inherited wealth incomes. Now, in terms of investing in equity, all that the financial instability argument requires is that some of the increasing income of the top 1% is saved in the form of financial instruments such as debt. To the extent that it's directly invested in equities, which creates wealth, of course that creates income in a subsequent period, which then has to be either consumed or saved. If any of it, at any point, if the marginal propensity to lend in a fixed income form is non-zero, then over time that debt to income ratio increases over time. So the relative, it does affect the speed at which these instabilities accumulate, but the fundamental fact of increasing financial fragility is robust.
Okay, we'll give Lars a break there. Thanks very much, and we'll break for morning tea and be back at 11 o'clock. Morning tea is now.